Any information or advice available on this podcast is intended for educational and general guidance only. Kem McElroy and KemMcElroy.com LLC shall not be liable for any direct, incidental, consequential, indirect, or punitive damages arising out of the access to or use of any of the content available on this podcast. Consult a financial advisor or other wealth management professional before you make an investment of any kind. Although Kem McElroy and his affiliates take all reasonable care to ensure the contents of this podcast are accurate and up to date, all information contained on it is provided as is. Kem McElroy makes no warranties or representations of any kind concerning the accuracy or suitability of the information contained on this podcast. Any links to other websites are provided only as a convenience, and KemMcElroy.com LLC encourages you to read the privacy statements of any third-party websites.
Welcome to the Real Estate Strategies Podcast, where we host in-depth conversations on everything real estate with the industry's biggest movers and shakers. I'm your host, Ken McElroy, joined by my co-host, Daniil. Let's get right into this episode.
Hey everybody, I'm really excited to have Thatch on today.
Thank you for being on. We've known each other. I've watched your stuff. It's amazing. We really got to know each other during Limitless last year through Tarl and through that crew. I think your content, your education, everything is spectacular. And I love the rags to riches story, you know, coming from Vietnam in 75, eight kids, I think it was. I think you told me, and your father had $100 or something, and you are very self-made. And I think a lot of people, you know, see us sometimes, because I feel like I grew up, not the same, but very similarly, shopping at thrift stores, et cetera. And my parents never went to college or anything, and just struggle. Let's start there, because I think, you know, I love your shirt, this mindset. Isn't it all about that? Let's talk about that, because How does somebody that, you know, they look at you, especially you, you've got all this education and how does somebody break through that?
I think the first thing, I was just talking to one of my friends just now before I hop in the call. She's been a veteran for probably 20 plus years. And she's in that, you know, January slump, right? Every beginning of the January, they're in a slump. Like, can I do it again? Right. And I said to my friend, I was like, do you have a 10-year letter? And she said, no. Then I said, well, you know, I would get older, right? You always got to think further out. You got to think outside of you. And when you get to think outside of you, then all your little problem you think you have, it becomes small when you really think outside of you. So to answer your question, mindset, if I started over and I look back today, what driven me when I was young with no money and got into the real estate business was I wanted to do it because I want to make more money. That was number one, because I was working at Safeway. I started real estate when I was 21 years old in 1991. And I graduated from college in 91 as an aviation mechanic. And, you know, at that time, you know, Alaska Airlines was like, hey, if you want a job, come out to Denver and you can fix airplane out there. And at that time, I was comfortable living in my mom and dad's house, right? Just came out of college. I didn't have no build. And I really didn't want to go to Denver and fix airplane over there in the cold. But I think it was deeper than that. I didn't really want to go out there because I wasn't really passionate about fixing the airplane. The reason why I even got into fixing the airplane, because my two older brothers, one of them is a pilot, one of them is a mechanic and a pilot. And, you know, in the Asian culture, if you're a doctor, a lawyer, a pilot, a pharmacist, that's like the prestige job, right? And you make your parents proud. Oh my God, my son is a pilot. And honestly, I wasn't inspired for me, you know? And I think deep under, I wanted to do something more. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. But one of my friends, I was parking car at a Chinese restaurant. And my friend Linda, her dad and the parent, they owned the Chinese restaurant. And she was studying for a real estate license. And she says, hey, how come you never thought about doing real estate? I'm like, never thought about it. I said, why should I get in it? She says, you got a good mouthpiece and you can make a lot of money doing real estate. And I said, how much money can you make? She said, 7% on every deal. And I thought, you get $7,000 for every $100,000 house you sell, which is not true, but it got me motivated. And so I got in there because I wanted more than just working at Safeway, because I came out of college working at Safeway, parking cars at a Chinese restaurant in 91. And I wanted to make more money for myself because I didn't want to make, you know, the $15 an hour. But then the second thing was my mom and dad gave me Vietnam with nothing. And my mom was a full-time stay-at-home mom. My dad was a social worker. And we lived in this really two-bedroom, one-bath fixer-upper. And, you know, I was the fourth child in the house. And my dad came home to work every day. My mom was full-time working. And I just see the struggle. And when I heard that you could make good money in it, one was, I want to make money for me. But then two, my why was, I want to help my mom and dad actually retire. Yep. And so for me, when people use the word mindset, I tend to break it down a little bit, you guys, and go, what is mindset, right? It can be as simple as being clear on what you want, being clear on why you want it, because that's mindset. Focus is mindset. Determination is mindset. Being hungry is mindset. And so for me, the moment I locked in, I want to make money for myself and I want to help my mom and dad. That was my single-minded focus. That was my inspiration. That was what I locked in. And then that became my determination to do what it takes to actually make money for me and retire my mom and dad. And that was the beginning of mindset. Today, mindset means something different to me. Today, I'm self-made. I'm good at financial. Today, what inspired me, which I found through a lot of spiritual practice, is my mission today is to inspire and empower beings and people to reach for their goals and dreams and see that anything is possible by me sharing my own journey and my own story. And that's why, if you look at my social media, I purposely make all my video telling story of my own life and what I do, the wins that I win, and the drama I go through, or the failure that I go through. So all my posts is all around me sharing my journey and my project and my lesson, and I give people that. So that's why my social media is so different from everybody else, because it's, again, it's about me telling a story of my own personal self. And when I do that, everybody can relate to it because they see myself in them. And that's, to me, mindset today. That's
true. Well, that's why you're at 1 million on Instagram. Like, it's crazy to see. And by the way, your stuff is fantastic. I love it. There's a couple of reasons why I really like it. In our world, there are people that are posers. Yes. And there are people that are really doing stuff. And you know, you're obviously in that category of people that you've been doing this for 30 plus years, and just like me. And ups and downs have been, you know, it's been hell at times, obviously, you know.
And one of the things I noted with this too, Ken, you can appreciate this. We don't change our course. So many people who I see in this real estate space, the moment things don't go well, they chase after the next shiny object to do or sell. Yeah. For me, been day one since 1991. That is my course. I stay in my lane when things are bad. You know what I mean? I just figure out the solution and I get back on course. I don't get, of course, when I was younger, I was always, hey, Dad, you know, would you want to be, you know what I mean? You can be great if you was in Mona V, because you have so many followers. You can make a lot of money being a downliner here and a downliner there, or sell this and offer this. And it just been one of those things, like, I don't need distraction. I'm doing real estate for me, not for a follower, not for downline. I'm doing it for me. And that's what I see today. So many people out there on social media, you know, when this month flavor is NFT. Next month flavor is, you know,
whatever
else. It's something else, right?
Yeah. I do know. I'll tell you the other thing. Well, there's been a bunch of lessons. I know we could go for hours here, but I don't think I learned anything in the beginning when I was making money. You know, I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. Look how smart I am. When I really learned was when I lost it. Like when I was like, oh, God, I didn't, you know, because you're blind. So, you know, you have your bias and your ego, and you don't have a lot of wisdom. Now, I'm still working on the wisdom part and the experience part, but, you know, gosh, I learned so much money when I lost my own. And then I learned more when I lost other people.
You know? Yes, that's even more.
Yeah. Oh, it was horrible. That was 2005. I'll never forget it. And sitting down with my investors, you know, and you know, but that is really, I was like, I will never have that happen to me again. Right? You really learn a lot.
So since you've both been through that in 2005, you know, normally we don't get two people on the show that have both been through the, you know, 2006, 2007, 2008
What do you see similarities right now, and what do you see differences?
I would tell you what I learned in 05. Well, again, when you were saying that, I'm thinking, man, are you my twin brother?
It's true, right?
In 2000 and, you know, that's six, you know, I decided to build, because, you know, it was, everything was looking hot at the time, right? So we decided to buy this property in downtown Seattle on 3rd and Cedar, buddy.
Right down the road from my
theater, okay? It's between Cedar and Bell Street, which is the, you know, Cedar is south of Bell, right? Okay? It was a whole block, right? And it was a property where this Chinese family owned, and he just got plans and permits for 251-unit micro apartments. And I don't know if you know the name called Jim Potter in Seattle, okay?
I've heard the name, yep.
Yeah, Jim Potter and Pinnacle, John Lugar, they all ran in the same circle. And so Jim Potter was one of the first guy in Seattle that started the micro apartment in Seattle. Average unit, 250 square feet. And this site was actually permitted for that. But when we bought it, we changed it up, cleaned it up a little bit. So it was me and a partner. And then we went and raised some capital and syndicated it. And what I realized was that in that 2008 market, everything looks great. And we got the property. We pre-sold all 251 units, and then we needed 2 years to build it out. Well, by the time 2009 or 10 came around, right, the market turned. And out of 251 pre-sold, 200 of them decided to yank their deal because we didn't get the offering statement all done yet, because usually those don't get done until the end of the year, end of the project. And so I realized after that, the bank would not give us an extension to do permanent financing. And we figured, you know, we gotta turn this into a rental. And I realized at that time my partner didn't want to go that route. He wanted to try to sell it. My biggest lesson I learned from that was it's so important to find the right partner when you do business. You gotta have the same mindset. You gotta have the same value. I'm all about taking care of people. Somebody else is all about making their money. I'm about making my money too, but I'm also about making sure that my people getting taken care of in the deal. This person over here was all about forget about the investor. I need to save my own ass to get my own money. Yep. That didn't work well, right? Yep. And then I realized also was I was relying too much on my own partner on research, where I should have done my own research also to make sure that I knew what we were getting ourselves into, and I didn't do my due diligence well. So that was a mistake for me. And then the third thing was reserve. Cash. We didn't have a lot of reserve cash laying around.
Cash.
Right? If I had cash, I wouldn't be forced. So we got all these stuff. We were forced to sell it, and equity residents end up buying the building. Yep. Okay? If I would have kept that building today, you guys, we sold it for $49.5 million in 2012, that building today worth over $75 million. Yeah. Would have been a grand slam. So I think what I learned today is, number one, I track the market a lot more now. I know what's happening with the single family. I know what's happening in the multi space, and I know what's happening in the apartment space. I have data, Fran, from commercial lender to residential lender, right? We cross data now, you know what I mean? And then now, everything I do, I got to have lots of reserve cash at all times if I'm going to do anything. And I don't need to do big project to be impress others. If I'm going to do it, I better make sure I got my ducks and my money lined up in case something go wrong. Like, I just finished doing a 35-unit apartment building in Seattle. And there was a water main that I had to do that the city did not really, they didn't tell me I didn't have to do it. Now, halfway through the project, they told me, you know what? I need you to upgrade the water main. I want you to do it earthquake proof. That earthquake proof cost me $200,000 over budget just for that one item, and the bank wouldn't finance it. I had to pay cash for it.
Yep. Yeah.
So that was some of the lessons I learned today. But I think there's a great opportunity out there. You just better know your research. You better have the right partner, and you better have some cash reserve if you're going to play these games.
Yeah. Good question. I think from my standpoint, one of the things that's the same from call it, you know, now or maybe 6 months ago to when I was on that role as well, was that I believe next year would be better than this year, you know?
I agree.
So that's the one thing, like, I'm like, yeah, like, we just, you know, we're slaying it. Things are good. Things are going up. And not seeing the signs, the red flags that are there, that were there. You know, I was doing the condo conversions at the time. So well, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We had just finished a 301 unit project on the Willamette River in Oregon that we bought from the NATO family. And bought 301 units from Goodman, John, actually from Pinnacle. And I converted it. So buy them for 100, sell for 200. And I was doing that in Tucson, Scottsdale, Portland, and some other place, Vegas. And so I had multiple projects going. And then what happened was, just like you said, I had contracts on properties, on units that weren't quite done yet. So we were a little bit different. We were renovating them. And then when the lights shut off, man, and you know, when they shut off, they shut off. And all of a sudden, you're stuck with whatever you have left. In other words, you basically go from selling condos to not selling condos, you know, in less than a week. And so I had hundreds of condos still hanging out there in multiple projects. Well, my Vegas project, I had 65 condos left, but I was in the money. You know, I'd paid back the senior and the mezz and everything. So that was all profit. That was like $12 million sitting there. But at the end of the day, it ended up being like 5 to 6, you know, because we just discounted them. But the one that killed me was I was too early in the project and I wasn't quite through the debt and all that. And that's the one where, you know, I had cash. I think my partner and I had $500,000 each, but we'd also raised some money from our friends and family. And that's the one that we ended up having to convert back to an apartment building. And, you know, of course, it doesn't have the payout and you got the big equity with the expensive equity, I'll let's call it. You know, all of a sudden we're like, we're going backwards fast. And then, you know, what my big lesson there was the documents.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, when shit hits the fan, you know what comes out? The legal document.
Yes.
And so that was my lesson there, Thatch, was really, 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 really understand what you're signing. You know, because oftentimes, by the way, I'm sure a lot of people do, but when you're going and blowing and refinancing and doing stuff, you're signing stuff. And a lot of it is really, really difficult legal terms. You really need to understand it because that's when basically the contract came out and they followed the contract, period. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, shit, like this is, you know, these are all the things. And cash, of course, cash is king. And that's what saved my ass during the pandemic was right now, Ross and I have about 10,000 apartments and we were at like 60% loan to value and we have lots of cash. And so, you know, we weren't freaking out too much because I'm like, you know, all we got to do is collect, you know, like 75%, 80% of the income and we're going to be fine.
Yeah, I agree. I think when you're dealing with big commercial site, people don't realize it takes a lot of cash to do it. People don't realize the cash sit in these projects for a long time before you see it coming out. And then you're going to need a lot of cash on reserve in case for rainy days. You know, we just finished our 100 unit in downtown Oakland and over there by Lake Marriott, right down by the water. And nobody expected the rent was going to go down 10 to 15%. Of course, you know, when the rent go down, the appraised value go down. Right. Not because the building wasn't worth it, because you could replace, it cost us probably 30-something million to build this building, right? But you couldn't build that building today because just the land by itself was probably already, you know, $8-9 million, right? Yep. But it's just the rent went down. But when the rent went down and we got all leased up, right? The bank wouldn't appraise it, you know, only for a certain amount. So the bank is like, well, we need more money down.
Right.
Right. And so we have two choices. Do we go back to an investor and ask the investor for more money? Right. Or we already asked him for money already. And for me, I just hate that feeling. So we have to put up another $2 million. So me and my partner, he's like, you know what? We're not asking for investment. Let's put our own money up and let's dump it in there and let's be done with it, because I don't want to have to go back ask all my friends for more money again. You know what I mean?
You know.
And I wasn't in the financial position, and I wasn't smart back then when I did the building in downtown Seattle. I wish I had cash, because I could have saved a lot of it. You know what I mean? That building. But I learned today. You know, that's why a lot of people say, oh, having cash sitting around is stupid and you can leverage it. I believe this straight amount of cash you sit around for rainy days, and then the rest of it, you can now go and leverage it. But if you emptying out the account to leverage everything, you're not thinking about also the rainy days.
That's right.
What mistakes do you guys think that people are making right now that are newer syndicators? Because, you know, you guys have been through this before, so I know that.
I'm already seeing it. Like, yeah, we're bidding on. We offered on 50 deals last year, 2022. We ended up with two.
Wow.
So what that tells you is that we underwrote hundreds. The investment committee actually looked at 50. Now, when I say the only reason I bring that up is because on those 50. There were multiple bidders.
Yes.
Everyone. On every single deal was a separate deal in a separate city, separate brokerage. And they were all, there must have been 8, 10, 20, 30 offers on every single one. So I know the numbers. And what happens is you start to see people stretch.
Yeah.
And they stretched. You know, I'm really in my box. Like, I have a cash on cash number, and I know, you know, what I'm willing to push. I'm not trying to do deals to make fees. Yeah. Now, a lot of the syndicators were trying to close stuff, you know, so they could, you know, pay the light bill or whatever. So yep. That's number one. Number two, they didn't hedge their debt.
Yes.
So that's the big issue that I think is coming. And what I mean by that is they, you know, the lenders were given these teaser, you know, call it bridge loans or variables or whatever you want to call it, but they're low interest loans. And let's say if anybody bought anything in 21 or 22 and they had one of those loans, that those loans are went from 3 to 6.
Yes.
And so now they're hemorrhaging, you know, because if they bought rate caps, because at the time they probably thought, why would I need a rate cap? Then now those are starting to expire. So what's going to happen is that said it earlier, you know, the building is worth less to the next person because the cash flow is less. So all things being equal, even if rents are the same, expenses are the same, if debt goes up, cash flow's down, and the buyer's paying less. So all of these people that bought, they're in this position where the buildings are not going to be worth what they thought they were going to be in the last 2 years, in the multifamily space at least. Yeah. So that's what I see. And how about you?
Yeah, I feel the same way. You know, if they're not getting, if even they have the same amount of rent, but the rates is at 6%, which is commercial loans, ridiculous high right now, right? Yep. If the loan expired, the next buyer, you know what I mean? We want to buy. They got to buy it at 6% interest rate. They based the number on the 6%. They got to pay you less. A lot of these guys can't hold it because, number one, they didn't have a lot of equity in these deals. Yeah. That's the problem. If they had equity, they can ride through the tough times, right? And some of these guys didn't have a lot of equity. So, you know, for me, I'm all about when I buy property, I got to make sure I hit, you know, 25-30% plus margin in equity on my deal. We pretty much build a lot of our own stuff from scratch.
Yeah, which is
right. Smart. Yeah. We build multi-unit. We even build apartment building from scratch. So when we build it, you know, we get a lot of equity, and that's why we could save our building in downtown Oakland. We just got done with it because we got hit with the high interest rate. But we only owe something like $19 million, but the building was appraised like at $32-33 million. But the bank only appraised it only for like $18 million based on the rent.
Yeah.
Right. And so we have to come up with some money, which is okay. So even though the building is leased up now, we're not making a kill cash flow on it because of the lower rent, but the builder got a lot of equity in it. You know what I mean? Based on what we know the potential of the rent is.
Yeah.
So right now we're locked in, you know, for 7 years on a brand new loan, and we're just going to ride it. keep raising the rates. I mean, rates in India, the rent, and we're going to be in good shape when this thing turn around again. But back then when I did the building in downtown Seattle, I didn't know anything about that stuff. You know what I mean? Make sure you get the right equity. Because the building we did downtown didn't have a lot of equity. We were doing it for the wrong reason. Let's say it like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's right. You know what happened in Austin, I bought a building in 05. And, you know, Austin at the time was hot, just like it's hot now. Well, 07 and 08, it wasn't so hot. So, you know, so I had bought this building. There's 230 units. And all of a sudden, the value was a lot less than what I paid. But what saved me was I solved the cash on cash. So my renters saved me because, to your point, I was covering the mortgage. I was covering. Now, I didn't have the capital gain or the equity in there anymore, but I just wrote it out until Austin started to recover. And it took quite a while, 4 or 5 years maybe, but we just ran it the best we could. And then all of a sudden, boom. It went up again, and all of a sudden, you know, through that whole period, I think that's the issue that a lot of syndicators have. First of all, a couple things. One, if they use any kind of managed money, so whatever it is, like doesn't really matter, family office, private equity, you know, institutional equity, it really doesn't matter. They want that money back in 3 or 4 years. So that's a problem because that's what happened to me in my condo conversion. You know, I had Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch. And, you know, they were like, okay, well, we want the money back in 3 years. I'm like, well, you know, I need more time. Nope. And so when you're doing the high net worth friends and family model, you can ride through those periods of time and just communicate really well to the investor, to the LP, and say, hey, you know, the market's down, we're cash flowing, we're still returning a little bit, but it's going to be a little bit longer, and you have that flexibility as with your equity. And I think that's what a lot of syndicators don't have going into this new period.
And I want to create this too, you know. With social media now, you know, really become more present in the last 12 to 24 months, right? Even more now. And I know it's going to even be more even later. Like, I started Instagram just 2 years ago. Right. And I see what it is 2 years now. I mean, it is just like a big giant billboard now. Right. And I see now this everybody is a goddamn real estate syndicator.
At the right time.
You know what? Then you look at the tracker and you're like, what have you done before syndicating? Well, I worked at McDonald's. I bought one rental property. I flipped the house and now I'm syndicating. Holy shit, this is crazy.
Yeah, and raising real money.
Right, real money too. Holy moly.
Because they, you know why? Because they think it's going to go up.
Well, so that's what I was going to actually ask is, do you think some of these newer syndicators don't actually have cash flow in their deal? So they were just buying based on selling for more.
Well, that's why I brought that first part up on the 50 offers. I mean, we made 50 offers, by the way, that, you know, we... The reason why I brought that up is because I know my top end. I know exactly what I could offer, you know, and that was it. And you have to be able to walk away. And so I know that those deals went for more than I would be willing to pay. And I also know what the lending environment was, what the equity environment was, what the value add was, who their team was. And I watched all that stuff get sold. And of course, the seller's happy, the broker's happy. But the, you know, the unknown is, you know, are they going to be able to pull that off? And what I found, to Thatch's point, the biggest issue these syndicators have, they don't know how to run a business.
No.
They don't have a team.
Yeah.
All they know how to do is find a deal on a package and raise money from some seminar that they went to. The right. Rest is really, really hard.
It's funny you said that because I wrote down team right before you said the word team.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
I know so many. I can tell you story after story after story where I know people who might have owned 5 or 10 rental property. And then now they're doing commercial. Yep. Right. And they have, let's call it a network of people that they can probably tap into. And, you know, they can go out there, find some deals, and then they can go and sell to the network, right? I got this great deal. And the first thing I realize is that, well, look, see, my own self is the first layer of people is you got to have the right team. The right team calling general contractor. When you start doing commercial, you got to have a right general contractor, man. Otherwise, you are about to pay massively in just in mistakes, right? Let alone any unknown that someone don't know or a contractor don't know that he should have told you, right? Lenders, right? My lender, he's my partner. He does majority of the commercial lending in Seattle and across the United States. He's my partner. And one of the guys, I know, that do commercial, he project this much for rent and he project this much for this building when it's done. And when I talk to my lender friend, I'm like, that is over promising to the investor because they don't have no experience. Now, why are they so hard up? Because they raised money already in the bank. And the money paying the investor is already taken. They're going to find the deals. Otherwise, they're going to pay interest somewhere, right? Yep. Of course, then they make money on placing the deal. They make money on developing the deals, right? This is how they make money, the syndicators, you know what I mean? They don't have any of the team, the experience of the market, the timing in the market. It's risky. It's massively risky. And a lot of them I know right now, they're paying the price right now in this market right now. Right now.
I know. I tell you a funny story. Like my partner and I decided to sell some assets, and just take some chips off the table. But only before we went into some of the units and we tried to upgrade them and tried to see if we can get more rent. And, like the decision that we made took 6 or 8 months. First we went and tested things. We did 4 or 6 units, different kinds, and we're like, okay, can we push rents? Can we not push rents? So we decided to sell some projects and in markets. One was in Houston specifically. And I said, let's sell this one. It's mid-90s property. It doesn't look like we're going to move the needle in the next few years. So we get into escrow. I get the package to raise equity from the person that I'm in escrow with. So now my buyer sends me a package not knowing that I'm on their list. And you know what it says? This bad operator, lots of room in the rent, the expenses are too high on a property that I own.
Right? Oh, yes.
It was the best. So I sent it to my partner, Ross. I go, check this out. This is awesome. And, the lesson was you can put anything you want on a piece of paper. And honestly, I hope that maybe I was wrong. And I hope that they did what they said that they could do. And maybe it is that I missed something. But the point is, I got their package and it looked pretty nice. Like, oh, this is a nice little deal. And, we ended up selling it to them. And I didn't know what happened after that. But to your point, you can put whatever you want. You can put whatever numbers you want on any spreadsheet at any time. And I always say, trust but verify, right?
Yeah. I think, there are a lot of people did not see this commercial space turn that fast. Yeah. It literally, the faucet got turned off literally within like 30 days. Correct. Especially the rest, especially in the Bay Area hit the hardest because they're they're the Silicon Valley, a lot of people go. So our building, surprising as it is, I mean, we're probably one of the best location and we still got hit, pretty hard, 15-20%, lower in rent. But I think everybody did not expect, the market was going to turn this fast. And the people that are doing the commercial syndicating that doesn't have a lot of experience and don't have a lot of cash, they go into the investor asking for money, 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, And I know there's a lot of people right now, they're in a bad spot right now in this commercial space because they ain't been around long enough.
So what does in a bad spot mean? Like, how does it all unfold for those that maybe are an investment in a deal that's not working out or that's listening?
Dan, you want to answer that first? What's your point?
So I was just at National Multi Housing Council last week in Vegas. I flew out there. There were 12,000 people. every lender, every bank, every broker, you know, and then, of course, most of the people in the multifamily space were there, a lot of them. And I went, I hadn't been in a few years, obviously COVID and pandemic and all that, but also I wanted, we haven't seen good deal flow, as you know, in the last 6 months. And the reason is that there's a big disconnect between the seller, as they're looking in their rearview mirror, and the buyer's looking in the windshield, you know, and the buyer's saying, okay, this, and so there's a big disconnect, bid and ask. And so what I found is that there's now talking about distressed funds. So at this conference, there was a lot of buzz around putting together distressed funds. So what does that mean? Essentially, it's going in to clean up the stuff, the question you just asked. So, you know, $100, $200, $300 million funds to go in and basically squeeze out the syndicator that's there because they own nothing, reposition the property, put the capital in front of the limited partners that are already in there, so, and take over the project. So it's a great way to take over and save a project and step into what might be pretty good debt, perhaps, or recapitalize the debt. So you can, in other words, you can go in and I can go raise money, especially from institutions, at significantly less than what debt is today. So, you know, so you can go in and buy the whole project and erase the whole thing. And you'll have now this beautiful physical asset that maybe they have $100 million in, let's say, and maybe it's worth 75 or 80, and you might be able to buy it for in the 60s. And then you wait again. And so that's what's happening is it and Thatch touched on earlier, maybe it's their loans matured. Maybe it's their equity wants their money back. Maybe they don't have enough capital. Maybe the rent's dropped. Maybe they got hit with property taxes and some expenses that they didn't know. Whatever the combination is, or you know, or maybe they have, you know, some issues going on inside of the partnership. Whatever it is, those are in distress. And the only way out is, think about it. The asset pays everybody, period. There doesn't come from anywhere else. So if the market doesn't support the price, then somebody gets squeezed. And in the capital stack, the first thing is always debt. Then there's equity. Then there's the GP. So what'll always get paid is the debt. So what's happened is it happens every single cycle is, as the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked, right? And that's essentially what's going to happen next.
Yeah. I'll give you an example for us, right? When we broke ground, we had a construction loan that was 2 years. We figured it was going to take 2 years. And we got the construction loan. And then we were supposedly be done with the construction in 2 years. And then roll it and lease the building and get the build filled up. Well, with COVID and everything, it delayed a lot of things. And so by the time the 2 year construction loan was about to expire, we were just finishing up the building. We didn't even have it even got started leasing yet. So we asked the bank, we're going to need an extension on the construction loan so we can another probably 6-8 more months, right, to actually have time to lease the building up, and then we can refi into permanent financing. Well, unfortunately, the market had already dropped to like 15%. The rent got lower. So the bank now go, okay, well, based on rent, if you're going to get this much, based on how many units, based on your expense, we only can lend you, let's say, X amount of money. And so they say, for us to give you an extension, we're gonna need you right now to put in another $1 million so I can extend you the loan for the construction loan. Now, think about this. If you don't have the money, you're going to have to go to your investor, ask for the money. If your investor don't come up with $1 million, you're not going to get an extension. The bank takes it back. Right. Now, if the investor only put up half of the $1 million, hopefully the partner, me and my partner, can put up the other half so we can get the extension so we can keep going and finish this project. If we don't have the money, then the investor put up half, we don't have any more money, the bank's going to take it back. This is what I say my problem, right?
So when the bank takes it back, do all the investors lose all their contributions?
Yes. Yeah. And what they do is they will finish the building off and they will sell it for what they can sell it for. And whatever they clear for them, the bank, the rest of them can basically be given, you know, to disperse back out to any of the investors. So technically, yes. You know, I mean, when the bank takes it back, you're almost going to say most of the money is pretty much gone.
And is there... Okay.
Right. So that's just one layer. So we put up the $1 million because we knew that we don't have permanent financing yet. So we know that if the rent's low, by the time we lease it and the rent's low and we go to permanent financing, we're not going to meet the debt to income because we know the rent's low. So we know the bank's going to ask us to put more money again. So I had to make a decision. Do I ask the investor for the $1 million now? And then I'm going to have to ask him for more money when we do permanent financing. And so we put up the $1 million to do it. We didn't ask the investor so we could get the construction loan, extend it, so we could have more time to fill the building up. Well, guess what? When we got done filling the building up, we already knew this. The rent's lower than what we anticipated. The bank owner's going to give us $17 million. We're in it for $19 million, but the building is worth $32-$33 million when this thing is leased at this level. And we know it's just temporarily lower. So again, we got to buy time again, right? But we need it. So the bank said, we need $2 million. And that's when we went to the investor. We say, we got to get permanent financing with the building's lease, but we're short. We're raising $2 million. Whoever put in the $2 million, you got to get a special preferred on your money. And guess what? Not every investor put up the $2 million because it wasn't required. So they only put up about, I'll think about, out of $2 million, $1.4 million. Guess who had to put up the rest of the money? Me and my partner again. Yep. And that's how we end up doing that. And then after we got permanent financing, now we're done. So when I say in a bad spot, imagine syndicators who don't have money. They would have lost the building for the investor in right there in that scenario.
Yep. It's the same thing that happened with our project that I was telling you about. You know, when you start a project, we had a $60 million deal, 40 of debt, 60 of equity. Then you start. Well, when things progress, if you don't hit the 60, like in our case, you know, and all those costs, you know, remember? You had a $7.5 million budget bust. Well, that $7.5 million comes from something.
Yes.
The bank's not gonna go, oh, you guys, I understand. Like, we're gonna give you, you know, $7.5 million. You don't have to worry. So that money has to come from somewhere.
Right.
And, you know, so that's what's going on everywhere, you know, whether it's new construction, renovations, value adds, not in every case, but the Thatch's point, the people that have cash, like in our case, you know, Ross and I funded that, figured it out to your, you know, we thought it was going to be worth in the mid 80s. Our appraisal came in closer to 100. So, mm-hmm. You know, we were way in the money. So if I was looking at it like a $7.5 million loan. But the point is that if I wouldn't have had that cash, some shark could have come in and said, listen, this is that distress fund. A shark comes in. They know I got 20 in. They got a 40 debt. I'm also signed personally on the 40. And they see this equity and I can't figure out how to get that 7.5. That's the distressed fund money.
Well, and those sharks, they're called sharks for a reason, right? They're not that nice around things.
I know, it's true.
And you know what, here's the thing, you can't even blame them because they were smart investor and money people who basically didn't over leverage and they got money and the people in a great position. You know what I mean? That because look, they're not needed unless someone is calling for them.
Correct. Yeah. Yes, and it's I mean, you know, you've even dealt with a little bit of this, you know, where I mean, there's a time and a place for those folks, and it's expensive money, it's short term, it comes with a lot of teeth, which is why they call them sharks, and so that's what the distress fund was. And so I had somebody, I talked to one guy. I go, what's the CBRE? What's the best deal in the country that you think? And he goes, hands down, this deal in Chicago. And he explained the whole deal to high rise. Apparently high rise are getting killed right now in most of these urban areas. And he explained to me, and I'm like, dude, that does sound like a hell of a deal. Cause the thing was at one time was worth, you know, in the several hundred million. And I know that you could snap that up right now for under 100. And so some institution probably will. and then they'll just hold it, and then they'll try to fill it and wait for Chicago to, let's say, recover. Now, that might not happen, might not work, but that, you know, but that's the distressed fund type stuff. And if somebody comes in and snaps that up, they're going to have their own plan, whatever that plan is. But somebody loses that, and so all the money that did that project is gone. It gets washed out, new money comes in.
Let me ask Ken this. I'm just curious. Yeah. What do you think about all these investor, other the syndicating non-credit investor now these days? I see them going down that path. I'm like, I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for the investor more than the syndicator. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I started in the business like you when there wasn't crowdfunding or anything like that. And I watch all that come out, and it scares the heck out of me, because I have enough angst just with my accredited. You know, I'm like, okay, like I have people that wire me money, probably like you, and, you know, they don't really understand, and they're accredited, by the way. And I'm like, okay, I want you to understand, like, you know, I want you to understand everything. So I can't imagine. I always think of like my mom. You know, my mm-hmm. mom was a hairdresser her whole life. I know, you know, I'm supporting her. We're supporting her financially. I think of that. I think, you know, what was it if it was her last 10 grand? And that, I just tell you, that's a whole different game. I would never go there. It's just, I don't have the stomach for it, Thatch. How about you?
Oh, man. First of all, I'm today, you know, I don't care about doing thousands and thousands of units. I'd rather do, you know, a couple hundred units with my own money. Don't syndicate. I don't syndicate much at all anymore. You know, I'm Oakland. I just got done with Oakland. And I say to myself, look, I'm 52 years old. All right. How much money do you really need? Yeah. I got plenty of money. I got plenty of assets. I got plenty of cash flow that will have, you know, to leave for generation after generation. And so I'm asking myself, I'm 52 years old, right? You know how long it takes to do a building, or, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. Yep. If I do another building today, 5 years, I'll be 57. I don't know if I want to deal with sitting in a board meeting reporting to a bunch of investors and bankers and, you know what I mean, everybody else. So today, for me, I can't speak for other people. You know, I have plenty of money. I have plenty of asset, plenty of passive income. I just want to enjoy my second half of my life and enjoy the fruit of my labor all these years. And travel and just do deals because I like doing deals, but not trying to push the envelope and try to do a 1,000 deal raise. You know, I mean, Ken, I know you do this. I know you get the same thing. I get DMs by so many athletes, celebrities, influencer, friend, millionaires and multimillionaires sending me, you know, one of my friends, you know, he's a big, big sports player. You know, he's getting, what is it, $300 million for like 8 years? He's like, that, man, take my money, bro. Put this shit to work for me because I got 8 more years left, and I want to come out and I want to have my money parked in some good stuff. Take it from me. And I'm like, man, I want your money, right? He want to give me $10 million. I don't want it. You know what I mean? But let me teach you how to do it. Let me teach you what to look for. So if you ever go do it, I don't want to be involved with nobody's money because I don't want to be in my I-60, 70, sitting in no damn board meeting, no banker board meeting, you know, investor board meeting. I'm good with it. You know what I mean? That's why today I just want to just teach people how to fish versus me taking them in. I want peace of mind more than anything now.
I completely agree. You know, and I know, I looked at our investor list. We're at 6,200 people. That's how many people have asked to invest with us, you know?
And
there's a lot. I think we actually have somewhere in the 600 or 700 right now in our deals. So we have, call it a waiting list of over 5,000.
Wow.
Which is ridiculous, right? So
wow.
To your point, there's more money then there are deals, and even those are really, really, really hard to find. And when I was a young man, I believed that I needed to have the money to go out and do the deal. But now I realize that the deal exists when I see it.
And what's crazy is that if there's more money than there is deal, I don't really understand why
some syndicate even go after non-credit investor. Jesus, are you telling me you ran out of credit investor? Are you kidding me?
I know. I don't understand it. I do agree with you. I think that is a potential problem because, you know, and not to mention the fact that that would just make me feel terrible. There's a reason the SEC sets the accredited investor at what it does. And there's rules around raising money. But I think, you know, it's, you really, it, when you're managed, when you're taking somebody's money, it's serious.
It's serious.
It needs to be taken serious. It needs to be handled seriously. And it's not yours ever. Like, right?
That's serious. Yeah.
So let's hop into Limitless. We have them speaking.
Yes. Oh, dude, how about that? June 15th, 16th, 17th at Scottsdale. But, you know, I don't know if you know, I was talking to Tarl this morning, and, you know, we sold out last year, as you know. The biggest hotel in Phoenix is the Marriott Desert Ridge, and it only holds 2,000 people. And, I you know, it looks to me like, based on when I was chatting with them today, we're probably going to sell out again. And we're only in February. Crazy.
Yeah. It's going to be amazing, man. That was an amazing event last year. I loved it. You know, I got to a lot of big events, you know, and I think that Limited last year, there was a lot of deep content, worthy content, inspiring content, more than just coming to a big event and all you get is a bunch of fluff, yeah. Right? And so I appreciate it. You know, I put on the event, so I know what it has to take, you know, to make a good event. And to me, what I love about it is that it talks a lot about real estate, but it also talks a lot about entrepreneurship. Yeah. You know, sometimes I see people do these big events. You come in, you thought you go to a real estate seminar, and then next thing you know, it's a seminar, you know, 30% real estate, and the other 70%, it's about, you know, NFT or Bitcoin or something else. They're like, what the hell? I just got sold by this stuff.
Yeah, I know, like kind of like you, I the cool part about the where we are in our span here is, you know, we've both been investing for over 30 years, and I would say I was pretty OCD about real estate in maybe the first half of that. Then now I'm starting to look at other things. So I have the same questions a lot of people have is, do I put $100,000 here, $100,000 here, $200,000 here? You know, in this tech business and Bitcoin and crypto, whatever. And so I'm as confused as everyone else outside of my little world. And so when we were talking about putting together Limitless, I said, we need to get experts in all of these areas, just like we are in ours, and not have them sell. You know, just have them teach. Like if you're going to buy crypto or oil and gas or whatever it is, here's what you need to look for. And here are the things, you know, that you need to ask and these questions. And I tell you, it's very interesting how well it was received last year. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I agree, man. I mean, I talked to a lot of my friends there. You know, we had probably over 120 of my friends and students, you know what I mean, that came to that event. Yep. And they all loved it. You know what I mean? They thought that the event was well put together. The content was good. It wasn't fluff. And a lot of them already said to me, Thad, you speaking, I'm coming down this year, bro. I'm coming to see you again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Real Estate Strategies Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes and let us know what you thought of today's episode. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.